In this episode, we interview Dr. Joshua Gross to discuss weight loss drugs such as Ozempic and other GLP-1s, obesity and its causes, and our current understanding of this research.
Welcome to the Thriveology Lab podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Neil Utterback, that's me.
And Phil Dunwoody, that's me. Neil and I are both on the faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. Before we get started, Neil, where can people find us?
What a great question. Please subscribe to Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube, and we will be sure to respond. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you can also reach out with questions or comments at thriveologylab@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we have an interview with Dr. Joshua Gross. Dr. Gross is an assistant professor of nutritional sciences and biobehavioral health at Penn State University. He obtained his PhD from West Virginia University in cellular and integrative physiology and completed a postdoctoral fellowship in the laboratory of Dr. Mark Caron, thank you, at Duke University. As director of the Nutritional Neuropharmacology Laboratory in the Penn State University Departments of Nutritional Sciences, Biobehavioral Health, and Pharmacology, he investigates the molecular mechanisms underlying food reward and its downstream dysregulation of metabolism, particularly in response to obesogenic diets. His laboratory employs an array of techniques ranging from molecular pharmacology to behavioral analysis in genetically engineered mice to study how GPCR-dependent gut hormones, neurotransmitters, and dietary nutrients regulate food reward in the context of obesity, eating disorders, and diabetes. So welcome, Josh. First, welcome. Let me say, that's a mouthful.
Couldn't have said it myself.
Well, I'm hoping that actually you can. And and like really speaking of it more in layman's terms, how would you describe not just what you research, but also some of what you teach in your role at Penn State? What is it that you research? What is your expertise? What do you do as a professor there?
Yeah, still figuring that out to some extent. Relatively new to Penn State. I'm going to be hitting the two-year mark in August. And so just starting to teach some of my first classes, really just kind of seeding and getting, you know, everything in place and the wheels in motion for my lab and kind of carving out my own niche in terms of my independent research program. But really what I teach and what I focus on in my research, kind of a confluence of all my prior experiences in research. Some of the domains and keywords I think that are primary focus areas, this term GPCR that you mentioned, G-protein coupled receptor. So these, I'm sure folks have heard the term receptor at some point in time, but really what these are proteins that are kind of embedded in the outer portions of cells that allow the kind of extracellular and the intracellular environment to communicate with one another. And those kind of microscopic molecular level changes that happen at the level of the receptor and in the cell ultimately manifest or create some sort of biological response or some sort of physiological response or even complex behaviors. And so really, I think the fundamental focus and interest for me is understanding how kind of the nitty-gritty, nuanced, you know, molecular mechanisms at the level of the receptor in, you know, a single cell or a population of cells in a particular tissue in the body, how does that ultimately manifest or give rise to complex physiology and behavior that underlies, you know, pathophysiology and, you know, the causes and issues that we experience with, you know, diseases impacting public health. And really, the idea, I think, is if you can understand, at a molecular level, how these things are working, you then, in principle, can kind of back calculate or reverse engineer drugs that can normalize or can correct for those issues that are disease driving or disease causing. And so that kind of, you know, full circle approach is what we try and take in the lab. We start, you know, at the level of in vitro biology and test tubes and cell culture and petri dishes to understand what's happening, you know, at the cellular level, and then move on to animal models to kind of try and approximate how those changes at the cellular level are affecting physiology, and then kind of rounding back or circling back and trying to design or discover or kind of, you know, rationally, you know, create new drug candidates to try and correct those issues. So,
Go ahead, please.
Oh, and so GPCRs are really a key focus, and the reason they are is because they are the largest pharmaceutical drug class, and they've remained of that stature for decades now. So depending on which review article you're reading over the last couple of years, estimates are typically between 33 to about 50% of drugs, pharmaceutical drugs on the market today target GPCRs. So they are wonderful. They're spectacular drug targets. So certainly, you know, incentive in and of itself with respect to just potential therapeutic utility. And these things really regulate every system of the body, every cell type, every organ. So they're kind of infinitely interesting, you know, targets to study because you get to learn quite a bit about human physiology.
I love that, Josh. And I think, you know, partly what we Phil and I are constantly talking about is this sort of systemic approach, like looking at, typically we look sort of laterally. How does sleep, nutrition, exercise, community, all these things laterally all contribute to a system of well-being? What I love about what you've just sort of presented is you're also thinking about it vertically, one could say, sort of like from this lifestyle, but how can we dig down into like, what are the cellular mechanisms that are giving rise to some of these behavioral outcomes and stuff? And could you talk, so one of the things, you know, the rise of these medications in popularity, at least, I know like these have been around, as you said, for decades, but some of them like Ozempic or these others have given, you know, a terrific popularity of late. Can you talk a little bit about maybe some of the recent global trends in metabolic diseases, how we got here and why are these now a great option for people possibly?
Yeah, it's an excellent and very important question. And, you know, really, it's of no surprise to anybody that we're experiencing an epidemic. You know, some would argue, and I think statistically, it's valid to say a pandemic, that this is a global issue. We tend to see a disproportionately large, amount of obesity and diabetes and other metabolic diseases in what we often refer to as Western industrialized societies. And so I think there's certainly plenty of rationale to propose that this is really a consequence of modernity and industrialization. And we could dig into that, I think, a little bit more. But if we look kind of specifically at the United States, really where you see kind of the earliest major inflection point in terms of an upswing in rates of obesity and kind of piggybacking off of that, metabolic diseases like diabetes, we really start to see it in kind of the mid to late 70s. And prior to that, although obesity existed, certainly, it was relatively flat and relatively stable for quite some time. And really in the 70s, we start to see this slight uptick. And where that really takes off is probably in the late 80s to 90s. We see that really, you know, move, you know, from what may be somewhat like linear to maybe towards an exponential kind of rise. And we've hit what some, you know, propose as potentially a plateau at this point. Some projections, you know, suggest that we'll continue to rise at this rate. So just looking back, just to finalize that point, is we in the United States are around 42% obese. And if you couple that with our definitions for overweight, it pushes us into something approximating about 75% of the population being overweight or obese, and approximations for metabolic diseases like diabetes in, you know, the 20% range, and, you know, also some liver-based diseases that often coincide with obesity. Whereas back in the 90s, we were looking at, you know, somewhere between 10 to 15% obesity. So just in a couple decades to see an unbelievable increase.
So when you see something that's got a pretty stable baseline, like obesity, and then it suddenly starts shooting up, you know, we look to see kind of what else is changing in the environment with it, right? I mean, we know, for example, just to give an example, we with anxiety and depression, relatively stable baselines in adolescents and emerging adults, until you get early mid-2000s, you know, as the popularity of the smartphone increases, we then see this matching rise in anxiety and depression among adolescents and emerging adults. And that doesn't mean it's because of the smartphone. I'm not trying to blame smartphones here, but it gives us a place to look, right? To ask, like, okay, is there a causal relationship between smartphone use and these mental health issues? And so I guess the same question, if we see this obesity being relatively stable and then this sudden change, what's changing in our environment with that gives us a place to look about causation?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And I think the obesity field and this particular question really is a nice launch point into the proposed causes of obesity, because people have been looking at this trend, you know, this disconcerting trend for some time now, and really trying to map what other things in our environment, like you said, are changing and coinciding with that rise. And that's where you see the emergence of many, many different theories, many of which could, you know, probably be guilty of the correlation does not equal causation fallacy, some of which may have, you know, some basis to them. So probably the most glaring change is the increase in the amount of processed food. And especially if we track back to the 70s, although we had processed foods prior to the 70s, but as I mentioned, there was this, you know, noticeable inflection point, is where costs really started to come down quite a bit. And so affordability and accessibility of processed foods is certainly playing a key role. And that has certainly been increasing, you know, over this time span. You can get very, you know, granular, and some will, you know, suggest that things like seed oils, which are, you know, tend to be in processed foods, have gone up. Many will point to the late 70s. There were dietary guideline changes based on Ansel Keys' work and others suggesting that we should move to a low-fat diet. And food marketers and companies then, you know, in order to retain some palatability for those foods, stripped out the fat and put in sugar and, you know, kind of enriched and simple carbohydrates. So many on the kind of low carb side of things will point to that major change in the amount of sugar and its consumption. And if you think too, I mean, sociocultural changes in terms of more women increasingly going into the workforce. And so you're not cooking, you know, as many meals at home. And Michael Pollan and others going years back, I think, you know, make this very compelling point that one of the best predictors of your metabolic health and especially obesity is how often are you cooking at home relative to eating out. And I think there's an awful lot of truth to that. And so I think there are all these levels, you know, and contributors and factors that are probably playing in to that rise. But there have been many people really trying to, with mathematical modeling and, you know, trying to impose a lot of complex analyses to understand what's happening here. And it's still not entirely clear. And which makes it, you know, a fascinating problem to study because, you know, there's room for major important discoveries. But it has been a challenge to try and map what are the key drivers here.
Well, I think that challenge is so directly paid for by us, the consumer, the eater of the world. Like it would be easy to say, well, sugar is the problem, seed oil is the problem, because we want one bad guy, mm-hmm. but it's this field of bad guys that are conspiring. And I think what's really interesting about this work and the stuff you're proposing here is like it takes out some of the shame associated with like, I just don't have enough willpower. I'm just a bad person because I can't. But really what I'm hearing you say is like the environment has changed such that it's playing on some natural evolutionary behaviors, functions, desires in me, and corrupting those in a way that leave me vulnerable to the consumer. Can you talk a little bit about that maybe?
Sure. That is, you're precisely hitting the nail on the head there. What's really changed is the food environment over this time. You know, our genetics really haven't changed just in the 20th century. It takes hundreds and often thousands of years to see even minute, you know, genetic changes. So really, you know, what I would contend is that we have what's often referred to as an evolutionary mismatch here, where we're operating on hardware, you know, that was developed and, you know, designed from a natural perspective thousands of years ago, whereas the food environment that we're all interacting with now is completely and utterly distinct from those environmental conditions that all ultimately kind of crafted and molded all of these biological underpinnings that we're operating on. And so one anecdote that I'll share, anybody that will listen to this, I tend to share it with. So whether it be at the dinner table, out at the bar, or my family, or whatever. So I think it's an interesting point, though, with respect to our kind of evolutionary predisposition to overconsume foods in their current, you know, instantiation and how they're made now. And so there's a one of the leading obesity scientists is named John Speakman. And he has a background in evolutionary biology, but has moved into studying metabolism and aging as well over time, and really, really incredible, impactful, and thorough work. And he wrote a perspective piece a couple of years back now, where he was suggesting, or pointing out rather, that when we look at what often food companies and food marketers describe as the bliss point, and the bliss point really comprises this kind of perfect Goldilocks zone of different macronutrient combinations. So just the right amount of fat, just the right amount of sugar, or, you know, simple carbohydrate, just the right amount of protein. And these are pretty well defined. If you look at foods that contain the bliss point, it's really all those foods that we all rate as the most pleasurable and the most enjoyable and rewarding. So your pizza, your cookies, your ice cream, chips, you know, so on and so forth. They all, in general, tend to conform to this macronutrient ratio. And what John Speakman points out is that there are literally no foods that exist out in nature that contain that perfect ratio, except for one naturally occurring food that does contain that particular ratio. So I often, at this point, will pose to whoever the the audience is, if you can guess what that food is.
My mind immediately went to avocados as the first choice.
Yeah, I get that. I get that quite often. Avocados are a wonderful.
Yeah, I'm thinking fruits just because they're so good and tasty. But I'm
can't get the protein.
I'm guessing it's got to be something harder here.
and food may be a generous term here because it's constrained by age. But breast milk actually
is interesting
with respect to actually ascribing to the bliss point ratio.
And it's been a long time since I've had breast milk.
Right? John Speakman, I think, makes the very compelling point that from an evolutionary perspective, there would have been kind of positive selective pressure to overconsume foods that contain that bliss point, that macronutrient ratio, i.e. breast milk, because that was ultimately what conferred survival, especially going back into our evolutionary past where, you know, the infant mortality rate was incredibly high, especially compared to what we experience now in modern industrialized society. So heavy selective, you know, pressure to overconsume those foods. But once you are then weaned from your mother and you're not consuming the breast milk anymore, and you go out into the wild and you're foraging and you're persistence hunting, you would never then encounter a food with that bliss point macronutrient ratio ever again. So there would have been no kind of countervailing negative selective pressure against that overconsumption. And really, there probably would have been further positive evolutionary selective pressure in that we were much more in our evolutionary past susceptible to prolonged periods of fasting. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, indigenous hunter-gatherer societies may come across, you know, a large game or, you know, a very large, you know, patch of fruit or vegetables, and they would overconsume because they didn't know the next time that they would encounter that, you know, rich food source. And so we're also, to some extent, hardwired to overconsume within a single sitting, especially if we're unsure about when we're going to get our next meal. And we see this now in a modern context with food insecurity and those that with lower socioeconomic status that may have a similar kind of uncertainty with respect to when are they getting their next meal, and that may predispose them to, you know, eating more in one sitting. And that's what the data tend to tell us. So I think a compelling argument as to, you know, why is it that there are these perfect formulations of foods that we are just – that feel kind of uncontrollable. And we could also, you know, dive into how food engineering and food marketing has really capitalized on this. It's really, if you strip out the public health impact of it and divorce yourself from that, it's actually quite fascinating, you know, how over the years they have really fine-tuned and crafted these foods to be kind of maximally overconsumed and pleasurable. And there's a variety of ways in which they do that that tie in to actually how our system kind of evolved to consume and respond to foods. And food marketers have really, through engineering of foods, figured out very nuanced ways to circumvent those kind of biological safeguards that we have in place.
I mean, this seems to be so – there's so many things that I'll say are analogous to this where, you know, there are – pressures in our evolutionary past that result in us having certain desires or drives. And then the modern environment exploits those in a way that might actually be detrimental for us. So they made sense in our evolved context. But in the current context, maybe not so much. And this, you know, seeking foods that are really, really rich, for example, in caloric intake and other things, what might be one of these, and that if that's rare in my evolutionary environment, it makes sense to really enjoy it whenever it's there. And that drive doesn't go away because we're essentially unchanged genetically, right, for the last couple hundred thousand years. But yet the food environment has changed so much. And this is something Neil and I talk a lot about in the class we teach and in this podcast, that one of the why have a podcast on well-being, really, or why have a class on well-being? And it's because I think there's so much in our environment that actually leads us in unhealthy directions that you need kind of this deliberate focus, because the environment is not engineered for your well-being. It's engineered for the profit, for example, of food companies or smartphones, or, you know, they're engineering these apps to maximize the amount of time your eyeballs are on them, which might be bad for your health, but might be good for the company engineering it, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's this similar mechanism in a way, or So I'm going somewhere with this here. So so this is the challenge, right? When in a way it's swimming upstream, you might say, right? When society has kind of gone in one direction and you're trying to head in a different direction, that is really hard. And I guess I'm going to lead that into a question, which is, we know there's a lot of evidence that diets don't work, right? So, and we're assuming in this conversation that obesity is a problem, and at least it's at least worth mentioning. There's all this, you know, kind of this body positivity movement, and I think there are good things about that, but there are also at least some potential negatives, and that obesity is can be physiologically very bad for your health, right? And diabetes being a great example. So diets don't work, and I'm guessing part of the answer is our environment and that we're habit machines and whatnot. But this is, you know, more about this area than we do. So, you know, in other words, why would these drugs have a place in helping people who some would say, oh, well, they just need to exercise more and eat less. Mm-hmm. And but yet we have, you know, decades of research at this point showing that that doesn't really work well.
Right. Right. Yeah, so many ways to go with this question. And, you know, we can take kind of the scientific perspective, and there's been a lot of just incredible work done from animal models all the way up through humans to you know, in a very compelling manner, describe why diets don't work. There are, you know, elegant mathematical models from folks like Kevin Hall, leader in the field, that are predictive of why diets don't work. But there's also just the very clear and obvious food environment, you know, contributor, as you just outlined there, which is that we are immersed in a sociocultural environment in which food is everywhere. It's highly accessible. It's highly affordable. Companies are, as you alluded to, kind of capitalizing on these this evolutionarily ancient hardware to kind of co-opt our attention, really in a highly analogous way to what we see with social media, where it's kind of taking advantage of, you know, the pro-social nature of our species and really capitalizing on that, you know, for profiteering and whatnot. And so we're exposed, you know, incessantly, whether that be commercials just driving down the highway, to cues that have been entrained over time to be predictive of something rewarding and something enjoyable. And you couple that with just inherently encountering more stressors in our modern environment, and that, you know, can really amplify that drive to want to consume something a little more rewarding and pleasurable. And so I think, you know, part of it starts with just the sheer inundation of cues that we have been entrained, you know, and exposed to over so much time, to where we're having that kind of persistent and constant drive and craving to consume foods. And so I oftentimes, I'm getting towards maybe the end of the answer here, and I could track back towards the beginning. But I often, you know, if folks, especially in my family, you know, are asking, how can I, you know, just start eating better and avoiding, you know, kind of overindulging in foods that most people, I think, are quite well aware are not good for them. You know, the kind of proverbial junk food, which are now often referred to as ultra processed foods. People understand these are bad for you. But, you know, controlling the controllables is really all we can do. And so I often say controlling your food, your local food environment, is really the best thing that you can do. And, you know, what you have in your house, you know, I think plays a major role. Because, again, at the end of the day, especially a stressful long day, we are largely at the mercy of our underlying biology and drives and cravings and these cues that facilitate those drives and cravings. And so setting yourself up, you know, for success in terms of going to the grocery store and deciding, okay, I'm not going to buy, you know, these, you know, Reese's peanut butter cups because I know I love them so much and I'll be much more likely, you know, to indulge in them when the time is right. And so controlling your local food environment, and I think that also plays into really trying to minimize, you know, the amount of time that you're eating out, because they're just as food marketers and the kind of corporate model of big food, so to speak, is really taking advantage of a lot of the shortcomings that we have in terms of controlling our intake. Restaurants are doing the same, you know, for their own survival themselves. So, you know, putting as much butter and salt as they possibly can in the food is financially advantageous for them to do. And so my wife and I, we absolutely love going out to eat. We do it probably at least once a week. It's a very enjoyable part of life. But trying to, you know, control, you know, your own food, I think is a great place to start.
Well, sorry, go for it.
Oh, yeah. I was going to kind of dip back into the science. So maybe
let's go back to the science, because you mentioned mathematical models. And
yeah.
I know there are things about, you know, for example, as you gain weight and then try and lose it, you know, our body has these homeostasis mechanisms that then adjust and make it harder. But is that what the science models you're referring to, or what are they about in the layman version?
Yeah. And so, Kevin Hall has really spearheaded this. He's an incredible scientist who actually tragically just left the NIH, for kind of political pressure reasons. I'm sure he'll get picked up by, some very lucky institution, but he's been really, you know, on the forefront of nutritional sciences for years now and highly impactful. But he started, I think, as a mathematician and physicist, so he's kind of, you know, used that prior background to try and understand what are the kind of inherent underlying trends and biological drivers that make this so difficult. And so he had developed a model, I think it was maybe in 2011 or 12, goes by various names, one of which is the dynamic energy balance model. And without going too deep into the mathematical basis of that, essentially based on clinical trial data, human data that he's collected, if we lose any amount of weight, you know, we can think about this at the level of, you know, 1% of our body weight or 5%. If we lose any amount of weight, we do have a compensatory decrease in our kind of basal metabolic rate, which sometimes referred to as the umbrella term being energy expenditure. So our metabolism kind of turns down a little bit. It's adjusting to that weight loss to try and get it back to its equilibrium kind of set point, or what we call homeostasis. However, there's a disproportionately large increase in compensation towards appetite and drive towards appetite. And so mathematically, how this works out is that there's about a twofold increase in your appetite drive with respect to how many excess calories you'll consume, twofold more than the decrease that we typically see in metabolic rate or an energy expenditure. And so he developed this model based on existing data. And then to support that, I think it was 2016, it was published, called The Biggest Loser Study, where there was a popular reality TV show where obese contestants, you know, lost incredible amounts of weight. And then he looked something like 6 years later, and I think it was maybe 14 contestants, 15 contestants, and all effectively but one of them regained virtually all the weight. But what he observed as well is that their basal metabolic rate, their energy expenditure, which really tanked, really went down, you know, to an incredible extent when they lost all that weight, actually stayed down for quite some time, which made it even that much harder, even after weight regain, to kind of fight that off. So we have this kind of built-in compensatory mechanism that makes it incredibly difficult to fight off that appetitive, that appetite, you know, drive to overconsume food. And our body is adapting in a way that is ultimately disadvantageous for actually keeping weight off. And this is why with dieting and exercise, you know, we've seen at best maybe 5% weight loss. And it is incredibly difficult for folks to keep that off. And with respect to exercise, this has been kind of an evolving idea in the field. Herman Ponser, who wrote an incredible book called Burn, actually a Penn State alum. He was, I think, an undergrad here, and a, you know, prolific scientist right now in metabolism, proposed this. It's called the constrained total energy expenditure model. And he also does a lot of anthropology and anthropological work with indigenous tribes and societies. And he studied a tribe called the Hadza, which I believe are in Tanzania. And, you know, they're foragers and persistence hunters. And so they walk something like 10 miles plus per day. And his major discovery is that their energy expenditure, their basal metabolic rate, you know, in the background, how much are they burning fat, was actually identical to a sedentary Westerner in an industrialized society. And so this was really profound to him because, you know, most of us like to chalk up the obesity epidemic in part to, oh, we're just moving around less, we're more sedentary. But the system is so highly adaptable, especially on the energy expenditure and metabolic rate side of things, that it essentially will just accommodate whatever your activity level is, whether that's close to zero, it'll adjust accordingly. Or if you're walking or exercising all day, every day, it'll adjust accordingly. And really, there is this kind of heavy tilt towards the food intake side of things in terms of being the primary determinant of your body mass change over time. And this aligns quite well with what are called GWAS studies, genome-wide association studies, where we look across large populations of people and look for what variants or variation in genes may be predictive of a certain trait or certain outcome. And of the 1,000 or so genes that we have mapped to obesity, especially very severe cases of obesity, the vast majority of them are expressed or functional in the brain. And the vast majority of those are really regulating food intake or total energy intake. A couple of them are modifying, you know, metabolic rate, energy expenditure, things like that. But in large part, the primary lever, you know, that our bodies are calibrated to either increase weight or decrease it is really food intake. And that, to some extent, cut me off if I'm going on too big of a tangent here, but to some extent, I think that parlays quite nicely into the efficacy of GLP-1 agonists in that these drugs are what they – the lever that they are pulling on in, you know, the in the advantageous direction is the food intake lever. They are having very little – certainly very little direct effect on metabolic rate, energy expenditure, activity levels. Certainly a little bit kind of secondary to changes in total food intake. But the key, you know, lever that it's pulling on is modulating our food intake. And I think it helps provide a mechanism to kind of deal with our current food environment in which we are replete with these energy-dense foods that are crafted and designed in a way to be overconsumed and to kind of pump the brakes on that, which can be an incredible challenge for all these reasons we're starting to touch on. GLP-1s are an effective way to manage with and deal with that issue.
I want to come back to that and have you explain exactly what these pharmaceuticals are doing and how they're pulling on that lever. But just anecdotally, and I want to just highlight, I think, for myself and listeners, like that the system is deranged. Right. And like even as this morning, I was watching a YouTube video and there were literally back to back ads for Pizza Hut and Ozempic. And like, what? One, that probably says something about my algorithm. But also like that's and one of the things that seems to for Phil and I track through all of these things is sort of mindfulness. Like, how can you develop greater awareness of yourself, your environment. Like if I become more aware of how the environment is doing that, how I can be aware that Lucky Charms has a very colorful box and a fun mascot that has nothing to do with the food and yet makes me somehow want it more, how these things are happening, then maybe I can intercept that. But that also, I think, says that that sort of sides overly, and I'm prone to this, with the willpower camp. Like, well, just if you're aware, just buckle down and do it. But clearly for a lot of people, these GLP-1, and I'm hedging like GLP-1s, GLP-1 agonists, what does that actually mean? What am I talking about? Like these medications are life-saving for many people. And so could you explain, Josh, like what are they doing? How are they functioning? Why are they so good, so seemingly so good?
If I may, I just wanted to respond very briefly. Hopefully I actually keep it brief. I have an issue with doing that sometimes. So absolutely circle me back, you know, to GLP-1s, and I want to dive into that very deeply. But with respect to this idea of commercials and being exposed to, you know, the colorful, you know, ornate, you know, ways in which they craft cereal boxes when you walk down that aisle, it's overwhelming. Really what they're capitalizing on there is, and we have, you know, decades now of data in animal models up through humans, is that most people kind of have a misunderstanding of what dopamine, you know, which is often thought about as the pleasure, you know, neurotransmitter molecule in the brain, often have a misconception that dopamine is only working when you're consuming something pleasurable and enjoyable, which is certainly the case, especially the first time that you consume something very enjoyable and pleasurable, like a cheeseburger or pizza or a big bowl of Lucky Charms. But after just a couple exposures to and pairings of consuming that pleasurable, rewarding thing in a particular environment, what dopamine does much more so is facilitate what's often referred to as reward learning or neuroplasticity in the brain. It's really a kind of learning molecule in the brain. And what it does is to pair cues and different environmental contexts with the drive and the motivation to consume something rewarding and pleasurable. And so with just a couple pairings, what you see is that then you see the McDonald's arch, you know, after two times having a double quarter pounder. And immediately when you see that arch, you are hungry, you're driven, you're motivated. It's actually you know, it's mobilizing you, where you then, you know, turn off the exit to go get that food. And so food companies and our current food environment capitalizes on this kind of cue-driven or cue-stimulated dopamine release that occurs. And this is exactly what we see in trials in humans, where we can, even in a normal weight individual, if you give them kind of a high-fat, high-sugar, you know, snack or food for just a couple of weeks, they become hypersensitive to cues that would be predictive of that food, you know, being consumed. And more importantly, what's been shown, especially in a couple recent very high-profile papers, is that at that point you actually start to devalue what are healthy, kind of nutritionally balanced foods, where you become disinterested in those foods, and simultaneously you're becoming hypersensitized to all the cues in your environment that would drive you to consume the very rewarding, pleasurable thing.
That sounds like addiction.
Yeah, and it's directly analogous to addiction. So we should definitely circle back to food addiction later. I mean, it's a very contentious, very interesting
topic. Well, what you were talking about, one of the things we know about addiction relapse is that it's context driven, very much so, right? If I go, let's say I have an addiction issue with some substance, I am, you know, use free for a period of time. If I re-enter the environment where I used to consume this substance, or around people that were involved in the consumption of it, I'm going to experience the cravings. I'm essentially, it's somewhat related to these homeostasis mechanisms. I'm going to have a drop in neurotransmitters that would have been boosted if I took the thing, which is part of the craving and whatnot. And I hear you saying something very similar,
yeah,
about food.
Yeah, it is very, very similar. Should we take a dive into the addiction side of things, or?
I mean, let's talk about them in relation to GLP-1 and what, because I know, right, this, we all know at this point, you know, GLP-1 is used for diabetes and weight loss. Mm-hmm. But I think part of the emerging research we're now also seeing is related to addiction, which is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So GLP-1 it stands for glucagon-like peptide 1. And so this is what we often refer to as a gut hormone. So it's produced in our gastrointestinal tract, specifically in our small intestine and to some extent in the colon, the large intestine. And really what it's sensitive to is incoming nutrients. So it's really evolved as a tight nutrient sensor. So when, for example, we consume carbohydrate, it starts getting broken down through the stomach and into glucose, smaller molecules. That glucose reaches, you know, the small intestine. That'll stimulate the release of GLP-1 and other similar nutrient-sensitive hormones. And it does a couple of things. What it was originally discovered for and characterized as is called an incretin. And the incretin effect really goes back several decades, which was this very kind of simple observation that if we were to inject an animal or a human with glucose, we would see, you know, a certain amount of insulin release that would occur, you know, from the pancreas to try and clear that glucose from the blood. But then if we would have somebody consume orally, you know, a glucose or carbohydrate, that insulin release would be significantly higher than when it was injected. And this was referred to as kind of the incretin effect. And this kind of started this cascade of really an incredible kind of scientific story of discovery and incremental science that is fun to track through, of discovering what is this incretin, you know, in the gut, presumably. And it turned out it was GLP-1 and another hormone, which is now pharmaceutically quite relevant, called GIP, glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide, we'll call it just GIP. And so these two hormones are expressed in the gut, and when they sense nutrients coming into the gut, then they're released. And kind of the first thing they do, so to speak, is act on the pancreas to increase insulin levels. And the utility there from a physiological context is that insulin can clear blood glucose and move it into your cells for storage, you know, for later. The other effects that it has with respect to the obesity efficacy is that they are potent suppressors of appetite and food intake. They induce what's often referred to as satiety. So essentially a decreased interest in seeking out and consuming foods. And they do this kind of through two mechanisms. In the gut, they actually have a local effect there that is really important and I think often underemphasized, at least nowadays, in that they delay gastric emptying. And so this makes you feel full for a longer period of time. And we have what are called mechanoreceptors in our gut that are sensing the stretch and the kind of diameter of the stomach. And when we've all experienced this, you know, after a Thanksgiving meal where we consume way too much and we can, you know, feel the distension in our gut, and that's activating nerve cells in the gut, which are called vagal nerves, that are then firing and sending a signal up to the brain to tell you, stop eating, you're full, you've had enough, we need some time to digest this. And so by delaying gastric emptying, essentially how much of the contents in the stomach are going to dump into the intestine, by delaying that process, GLP-1 and GIP make you feel full for longer. But this can also lead to nausea and GI discomfort, which is by far the most commonly reported, you know, side effect. But kind of a tertiary effect that's critically important and been revealed over the last couple of years is that GLP-1 is acting directly in the brain in some of these kind of homeostatic feeding centers that we've been alluding to, such as the hypothalamus and the brainstem, and acting directly there at its respective or cognate receptor to change signaling in cells and ultimately to decrease food intake. So it has what we often refer to as a central effect in terms of inducing satiety and reducing food intake. And there's this, just to finalize the point there, GLP-1 and GIP are among a very large array of different gut hormones that are released in response to nutrient intake. And there are, you know, some subtle differences, but the vast majority of those induce or evoke satiety. And my favorite gut hormone, kind of the only one that actually produces appetite, called ghrelin, is kind of acting in the opposite direction. But
mm-hmm. Yeah. No, so you mentioned two things, right? Reducing the speed at which things process through your gut, so you stay fuller longer, and then being less hungry. I've also heard people, and perhaps this is related to the addiction part, also say that their taste for junk food goes away. In other words, they don't, like, I used to love this sugary cupcake thing, and now I want broccoli, right? Like, and so you hear people discussing that, which that doesn't seem like either of the two mechanisms you just described.
Yeah, and this is a very hot, active area of research right now. So okay. This really does kind of, I think, push us in that direction of addiction. So we've known from animal model work for many decades now that the receptor for GLP-1, in addition to being expressed very highly and playing an important role in those homeostatic feeding areas, hypothalamus, brainstem, it's also expressed in kind of higher order brain regions. And most relevant here is what we call the mesolimbic dopamine system. And that's often kind of colloquially referred to as the reward system mm-hmm. of the brain. And the mesolimbic dopamine system is activated by every single drug of abuse. And it's also activated by anything that is generally considered pleasurable and rewarding. So that can be chocolate, to sex, to social interaction, and then every drug of abuse. So really, the kind of the fundamental, you know, anchor point mechanism of drugs of abuse is kind of co-opting that mesolimbic system. And GLP-1 receptors are expressed within that system. And they do, at least in animal models, a pretty decent job at turning that system down, which is very much consistent with what we see in animal models and now in humans: reduced consumption of alcohol, reduced consumption of opioids and psychostimulant drugs. And really, there's this kind of common blanket effect where GLP-1 agonists can reduce the rewarding properties of palatable food, in the same way that it can reduce the rewarding properties of alcohol, as it can reduce the rewarding properties of opioids. And this is because this circuit evolved not, you know, to be co-opted and hijacked by cocaine, but rather, you know, to facilitate the basic, you know, evolutionary drives that were necessary for all of us to survive, which is really seeking out and acquiring food, especially calorically dense food, and also, you know, for sexual selection and in terms of driving sexual behavior. So really these it is no surprise that things like GLP-1 and what I study very closely, ghrelin, which is kind of the exact opposite and diametrically opposing force to GLP-1, are very highly expressed in these mesolimbic reward system areas and play a key role in those processes, because that system really evolved initially to drive food seeking and overconsumption of these foods. So GLP-1 agonists, it started really with anecdotes, and now we have, you know, emerging clinical trials, some of which are actually being done here at Penn State on the Hershey campus by Patricia Sue Grigson. Yeah, very, you know, compelling early findings. And, you know, I think we'll see, as we have known, you know, for decades in animal models, that it'll have a positive effect. And it's amazing. I think it's an amazing example of the conservation of this system, in that you hear often anecdotal reports that folks are less interested in, say, shopping, you know, on Amazon when they're on GLP-1 agonists. So they may have some kind of relic of a shopping addiction. And so we know gambling, shopping, sex addiction, gaming, whatever, it's all kind of interfacing with and coalescing upon this common, you know, conserved system. And by kind of tweaking and fine tuning that system in a positive direction, like we can do with GLP-1s, you know, I think we'll have, you know, this kind of blanket beneficial effect.
And you often see, I mean, in these sort of addiction or addiction-like behaviors, sort of comorbidities, or like you see, like, not only is there an alcohol problem, there's a food consumption issue, or there's a gambling and a sex and a this, and that there, that the system isn't just singling this out. It's sort of consuming all things in many ways. So it sounds, on one hand, these are the miracle drugs that they're being touted as, right? Why, if, you know, whatever your thing is, this might be the thing to help you quell it, right? So why would someone not want to take, what's, playing devil's advocate, what's the downside of these potentially?
Yeah, it's a great question.
It's an excellent question. I think it's the primary question on so many of our minds now. Mm-hmm. In terms of the efficacy of these compounds for obesity and diabetes, it is completely and utterly unprecedented. The most recent iterations, we can go into details of specific GLP-1 agonists on the market currently and coming on the market, are approaching what we see with bariatric surgery now in terms of the amount of weight loss. They've also increased,
which is how much?
Typically you'll hear anywhere from about 25% to 35% reduction in body weight.
So
whatever your starting body weight is, you know, reducing it by that percentage.
Over a year?
Two years? In clinical trials, for most of these GLP-1 agonists, the clinical trials tend to last anywhere between a year to 2 years. Typically, it's about over a year and a half. However, if we look back historically, the very first, this is a really fun anecdote too, which we could maybe circle back to later, but the very first GLP-1 agonist that was approved, FDA approved, was called exenatide. And this was in 2005. And so had relatively mild weight loss effects, kind of on par with most of the preceding obesity drugs that had been tested prior, about 5% weight loss or so. But that, you know, going all the way back to 2005, and then the next iteration, liraglutide, in 2010. So we have had these drugs for quite some time. So although we do have very rigorous safety and efficacy and adverse outcome data from our, you know, 1.5 to 2 year clinical trials, we also have our kind of, you know, what's often referred to as post-marketing surveillance data of individuals that have been on these drugs for, you know, going on almost 2 decades. And we haven't seen really the emergence of major, at least, you know, quite common issues. What we see Most commonly, upwards of about 50% of patients that take these drugs experience significant nausea, clinically significant nausea. And oftentimes, you know, if there is a point at which there is medication discontinuation or a lack of adherence to the drug, it probably is ascribed to nausea and just general GI discomfort. Typically,
that's not a small issue either. I mean, I've at least read some things suggesting that after 1 to 2 years, 50 to 70% of people stop taking GLP-1s.
Yeah. And I think there's probably a couple of reasons that that's happening.
Okay.
I'm sure that the GI effects are playing a role there. They have been able to, with fine tuning the dosing regimen, they use what's kind of an escalating dose titration, as it's often referred to, where you start very, very low and you kind of creep your way up. And that approach, which is becoming increasingly commonplace now for treatment regimens, has really abated and minimized, you know, a lot of these really problematic GI effects. I think perhaps some of the other reason that some of the other reasons underlying discontinuation, I'm sure GI discomfort plays a major role there. But I think some folks, they are so successful for a significant period of time and they change their behaviors in these ways that I'm not even interested in the cake anymore. I'm preferentially reaching for the salad. And that can kind of convince you psychologically, behaviorally, that you're ready to come off the drug and you're ready to then start applying, you know, those newly acquired behaviors in the absence of the drug. But what we've seen from clinical trials is that the vast majority of the weight is regained in the vast majority of individuals that discontinue treatment. And I think this is really a critically important point. So some will critique these drugs and saying, well, they're lifetime drugs, and that in and of itself, intrinsically, regardless of adverse effects, is problematic. But if you make an analogy to hypertension or even diabetes, which is often comorbid with obesity, or cardiovascular disease of any kind, nobody really second guesses the idea that you're going to be on those medications for life in order to reduce your risk. And so I think this transition in terms of increasingly understanding the biology and the genetics and the role that that plays in obesity and kind of diminishing this age-old idea that it's entirely willpower has moved us into the domain of viewing obesity as a disease. And I think that helps to enable the idea that these prescription medications are treating a disease, and oftentimes you'll need to stay on that medication, you know, presumably for life if you want to, you know, keep body weight in check and continue to reduce risk.
And these are, you know, cardiovascular health. I mean, it's the number one killer in the U.S. Yeah. I mean, so these are not small risks we're talking about. So I think when you're weighing, it's always good to talk about the side effects. And I think I would like to dive in a little bit more to those, but it's worth acknowledging that there are risks of not taking it at that point. Right. And so that's what you have to always decide and to discuss with your physician is those trade-offs.
Yeah, it's all about trade-offs. There's, you know, pun intended, no free lunch. And so every drug, despite GLP-1s thus far, you know, having probably one of the best safety profiles, especially when you balance that against its efficacy profile, is really, truly a miraculous thing. But there's always going to be trade-offs and risks. And I just wanted, before I outline some of the potential adverse effects and additional side effects, reinforce this idea, exactly what you said there, Phil, which is that the cardiovascular benefit, which has now been studied in long-term clinical trials, is pretty astounding. I mean, it's on par with, you know, some of our standards of care in cardiovascular disease. And cardiovascular disease is one of the primary, you know, risks that are conferred by having obesity, or similar effects are being shown recently with respect to kidney diseases, liver diseases, the excess accumulation of fat in the liver, which is pretty much always comorbid with or occurring alongside obesity, which is a major driver of metabolic dysfunction in the whole body. They're seeing positive effects with neurodegenerative diseases, which also risk is majorly increased with obesity, especially over prolonged periods. So, and these aren't really speculative or anecdotes at this point. We're accumulating and amassing an impressive number of well-controlled, randomized control, clinical trials.
We love data on this show. Yeah, exactly. We're always asking, show me the data.
I live and die by the data.
So nausea.
Yeah.
So what are some of the other side effects we see that might be problematic for people?
Yeah. So some of the most severe potential side effects that have been observed in human populations are pancreatitis. However, the estimates for the likelihood of that is, less than 1% of individuals. I've seen actually as low as 0.1 to 0.2%. So these are incredibly rare, but they can be quite severe.
And they've been on the market long enough where we would have some idea of long-term use at this point.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's an important point is that it's not as if these drugs are brand new. We have versions of these drugs that are quite new. Mm-hmm. And if we were to go, track through the history of, what are the subtle differences between these things, although biochemically, structurally, they're subtle differences, they do have major differences biologically. So pancreatitis is one. There has been some proposed risk potential for thyroid cancers. However, to my best reading of the literature on this, that it still exists kind of only in animal model research, and I don't know that we have compelling human data yet to support that as a potential risk. There has been quite a bit, especially on social media, purported risks around what is often referred to as kind of significant lean mass reduction or loss of muscle mass or potential bone density.
Mm-hmm.
And some recent work has come out, especially using existing clinical trial data out there by Kevin Hall and others, to pretty, at least by my reading of it in a compelling way, demonstrate that the lean mass loss that we're seeing is right on par with what you would see with, diet-induced weight loss just from caloric restriction. So it doesn't seem to be going over and above what would be expected with this amount of weight loss. But inevitably, you're going to have loss of muscle mass and just total lean mass because you're carrying around less weight all day.
And I've read like if you lose 10 pounds, 6 pounds of that is fat and 4 is lean.
Right.
Mass.
Yeah.
So what is lean mass? Can you define that for us? Because I hear that's a category.
Yeah. Lean mass is kind of everything other than fat.
Okay.
Yeah. In large part.
So it's not 4 pounds of muscle I'm losing.
No, it's not necessarily always muscle. Often, I think probably the most significant proportion is often muscle of lean mass, but that's just, general tissue weight. I mean, it's kind of everything else other than fat.
Bone density?
No, bone density is often segregated out as something distinct. And I think this is probably worth, and I'm maybe not as up to speed on the current literature of this as much as I should be, but this would be a concern of mine, particularly in elderly populations where lean mass loss and especially bone density loss, if GLP-1 agonists are to any extent, deleterious or problematic in these domains, that can be literally fatal in an elderly population because we know falls typically kind of precipitate, mortality that, is often seen in elderly populations. So I think we need to be quite wary in terms of prescription of these drugs with elderly populations until we work some of this stuff out. There's been also some, again, largely, I think on social media, most of the data doesn't trot this out to date, but around suicidal ideation and mood. And so it should probably become, come as no surprise that drugs that tend to be effective at treating or diminishing addictive potential of drugs or whatever it may be tend to be at risk of potentially inducing depression or at least a mild depressive-like state or suicidal ideation because by turning down that dopamine system, which is still what's fueling my enjoyment, coming on here and chatting with you guys or you know, what's great about, you know, being in a relationship with somebody else, or all these basic pleasures of life are being mediated to some extent by that system. So if you're turning that knob down too much, that can then trickle into some psychiatric or mental health issues. However, a recent meta-analysis, or at least a systematic review, I forget exactly what was done there, but I knew the primary conclusion was that with the existing human data we have thus far, there's no significant increase in suicidal ideation. And this kind of tracks back in part to the Rimonabant debacle in kind of the history of obesity medications. And just very briefly, this was, I think, in the 2010s. And the rationale for this drug was quite simple in that we know that when somebody smokes or consumes marijuana, it activates the cannabinoid system in the brain, a receptor called CB1. And that produces the classic munchy, you know, experience. And so if you block that same receptor with a drug, that you may be able to decrease the munchies and therefore lose some weight. Sure enough, they developed a drug called Rimonabant that did exactly that quite effectively. And individuals were losing a decent amount of weight, especially for the time, on par with 5, maybe 10%. But that drug ultimately got pulled off the market because it increased suicidal ideation. And that's probably in large part because the CB1 receptor, although it's the most highly expressed receptor in the brain, very densely concentrated in these mesolimbic dopamine reward areas of the brain. And we're probably just turning that knob down a little too much. So you have to, you do have to be wary if you are tinkering with those systems, that you're doing so in a way that still allows the individual to enjoy all the things that are great about being a human.
Well, what you just, I mean, you pulled on the word I was just about ready to say, like the system, that sometimes we think this drug will just do this thing, but all drugs are intersecting with a system. And so they often have a system wide changes and tracking that and making sure that, like, it's not just a one-to-one, but that also what I'm also hearing, and I think, you know, we didn't say this at the outset, but, you know, Phil and I are not medical doctors. We're not making prescriptions on this podcast, but what I'm hearing is that, like, it was not a this or that. It's not just that diet and exercise is one solution and these GLP-1s are another solution, that having a system-wide approach that might involve both some weight training, some resistance training to reduce the impact of some of that lean body mass loss, to do some cardiovascular work to amplify that, in conjunction with some dietary approach, in conjunction with some counseling to help through the ideation, with some all these things. It's not just a this or that, but how do we work on the system simultaneously?
Yeah, I've seen recommendations, for example, that if you're on any type of GLP-1, you should be doing weight-bearing resistance training to help try and counteract any loss to muscle.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's nothing but upside with doing that.
Yeah.
And you know, exactly what you outlined there, Neil, nothing but upside for doing all of those things. Those are advantageous, beneficial behaviors for all of us. But I think, yeah, if you are going to take the medication, it is particularly important to, you know, ascribe to these, you know, basic, you know, healthy behavioral hygiene, so to speak, just to keep the potential risks of, you know, each of these outcomes kind of at bay. And I think, you know, a little bit of weight, you know, weight training is going to go an awful long way. Same with respect to food choice. You know, there may be a biological drive to consume more healthy food, or maybe more accurately, to move yourself away from preference towards calorically dense food. But that doesn't mean that you take the GLP-1 agonist, and because you're consuming fewer calories and you're burning on average each day, you can eat nothing but the Reese's peanut butter cups. And, you know, that's going to have inevitably, you know, a metabolically kind of deranging effect over time, even if you are, you know, not consuming enough calories to be putting on additional weight.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, we did two episodes on nutrition and even, you know, dipped our toes into whole area of metabolic psychiatry or nutritional psychiatry, and some of the fascinating things to your point, like the more ultra processed foods you eat today, the more at risk you are for actually anxiety, depression, other mental health issues later in life, because of that long-term impact on the gut microbiome, if that's, you know, at least this is the assumption, right? If that's part of your diet. But we're about an hour here, a little over. So the last question, right? So what is, you're active in this field, right? So what's cutting edge now and in development or even, maybe even theoretically, and what do you see as potential? What's next, right, in these? What are we going to see as kind of the next iteration of this, and how is it going to improve or deal with some of the same issues that the GLP-1s and other things are trying to address?
Yeah, so there's a lot happening in the field. And
yes, it's big money. It's
really big money, and I think there's many different directions I could take it, but I think how I'll choose to respond to the question is plays directly into that, where there's this a bit of an arms race occurring, you know, in terms of who can design the best GLP-1 agonist to maximize the most weight loss. And so there is a corporate incentive, of course, to do this, because this is the biggest money boon we've seen in the pharmaceutical industry, I think, in history. And so the kind of very recent history of these drugs, it really started with optimizing how to make subtle modifications on these drugs so that they stay in the blood, you know, for longer, and they can have, you know, the beneficial effects that they're having. That's a very interesting story. But the more recent history over the past couple of years has been these what are often referred to as dual agonist and tri-agonist therapies. This maybe briefly harkens back to Neil's question, which I never answered, which is that all these drugs are agonists, meaning that they are activating the GLP-1 receptor. They are not GLP-1 themselves, the gut hormone, but they have subtle modifications that make them look an awful lot like the native natural GLP-1 gut hormone, but can still activate its receptor in the hypothalamus and these homeostatic feeding centers and the pancreas to regulate insulin, in the gut to regulate, gastric motility and emptying. So these drugs have been subtly modified to where they are typically about 90% or more homologous or similar in their sequence to native GLP-1, natural GLP-1, but they have these modifications that make them hang out in the blood for a much longer period of time. And so they kind of figured that out, you know, when they got up through semaglutide or Ozempic or Wegovy, they last for a week stably. They're, you know, activating the receptor and having all these beneficial effects. So then the next step was adding in additional gut hormone mimetics. And the first one they started with is this GIP that I referred to, the other kind of incretin hormone that I mentioned. And this is the basis of tirzepatide, which is called Mounjaro when indicated for diabetes, Zepbound when indicated for obesity. This is an Eli Lilly compound, which is both a GLP-1-like agonist and a GIP-like agonist. And this drug showed even further weight loss and even better glucose control than Ozempic, its predecessor. The most recent iteration, also from Eli Lilly, called Retatrutide, is a tri-agonist. So it's this GLP-1 agonist, GIP, and a glucagon agonist. And this has shown even further weight loss. And that's where we've started to tilt up into, you know, bariatric surgery level in terms of about 25% weight loss or more. And so,
because up until then, we've not seen anything work as well as bariatric surgery, right? Which is why you're referencing that.
Yes, not even close. I mean, if we were to go back through the whole history of obesity drugs, pretty much where it maxed out before, in large part semaglutide, Ozempic, was maybe 10% body weight loss. Most of them over the entire 20th century, a lot of stimulants, in large part, were about 5%. And at the time that the first GLP-1 really came onto the market in 2010, the approved medications were, you know, somewhere around 3 to 5% body weight loss. So this is just astounding. So much of the field is focused on kind of where do we max out at without you know, further increasing side effects and adverse, you know, adverse effect liability. And so that's a big part of the field right now is, I think, the financial incentive to keep producing the new and better versions. But better understanding the side effect profile, both acutely and long term, which in part will just take time. You know, we didn't know, you know, what the effects were of smoking for about 30 years, you know, afterwards. And so we have to be very cautious and not let the train kind of run away from us in this arms race towards better and better drugs, because we may be missing something that'll manifest 30 years down the road that we're unaware of. So on the research side, and on the clinical drug development side, it's really all about how do we formulate these things to maximize efficacy while still continuing to diminish side effects. And that's so a big part of what I study in my lab. I focus very heavily on this hormone called ghrelin, colloquially known as the hunger hormone. So it does all the opposite things that GLP-1 does, which actually, in I would argue, at least I do in my grants, that, you know, it's a great system to play along with in this kind of dual agonist or dual therapy mode, where we can use the ghrelin lever to kind of fine tune some of these problematic adverse, you know, side effects. So, for example, another one that I didn't mention earlier, gastroparesis. You know, part of the efficacy of GLP-1s is that they slow gastric motility and gastric emptying, as we said. But if it slows it to a halt, that can be a really severe problem. And this happens in some folks. Mm. Whereas the ghrelin system does the exact opposite. And so if you can figure out how is it that the ghrelin receptor in the gut is kind of competing with GLP-1 to, you know, this push and pull, you know, tug of war on gastric motility, maybe you can selectively, you know, keep the gastric motility, you know, at a regulated level or at least at bay, while still maintaining, you know, all the other beneficial side effects. And so I study that first kind of at the cellular level in terms of understanding how signaling pathways and different molecules within the cell downstream of the receptor are causing these effects, but also at the physiological level, how are these things occurring? And so I think, you know, pharma is really in this profit-driven race to, you know, see what can we do. And then I think trying to better understand side effect profile and liability. And I think also to expansion into, which we touched on, all these other potential therapeutic domains, that might be where most of the excitement is in the field. And so I was trained kind of foundationally as a neuroscientist and you know, I've gotten into metabolic physiology more over time, but so I'm oriented very heavily towards psychiatric disease and neurological disease and addiction. And a lot of my early work focused on that. And so there's an awful lot of excitement there in those right. domains. And I think one last important point just to tie that up is I think what's being looked at right now in the research domain is, you know, we kind of starting with, okay, we know these things are relatively safe. We can do clinical trials. We can do retrospective analyses in human populations. It's doing all these beneficial things. Is it doing that directly? For example, you know, reducing kidney disease or kidney failure. Is it actually acting directly on the kidney, or is this just secondary to obesity? And it's hard to disentangle that.
Yeah.
In many cases, it does appear at least in part to be secondary just to reductions in body weight and improved metabolic control, which I think reinforces the, you know, the point that obesity is a major risk factor for really, if you were to categorize the highest mortality, morbidity diseases, especially in industrialized nations, that, you know, it really is playing a key role. And by just treating that issue, that you get all these kind of secondary benefits. And so, yeah, there's a lot of mechanistic work. And I think also trying to tread lightly and not let things get too far away from us. But there's a lot of excitement and a lot of, you know, net positive benefit that's hard to ignore.
That's awesome. Dr. Joshua Gross, thank you so much.
Yes, you've been a wonderful guest.
Fantastic. Friends, That is it for this episode. Please subscribe to the Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube, and we will be sure to respond. And be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook. If you have any questions or comments, or if there's a subject you'd like to hear us discuss, please reach out to ThriveologyLab@gmail.com. Thrive on, friends.
Thrive on.